Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
And I was in the physics department there, and one of the PhD professors came in and whispered in my ear, "There's someone here to see you." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "It's a job interview." And it was in the fall semester. I said, "Well, you know, the job guys don't usually come till May when the students are getting out of school. You know, who is here?" And he whispered, he said, "It's the CIA."
On April 19, 1995, outside the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City, there was a massive bomb blast, leaving 168 people dead and hundreds more injured. This blast is said to have been set off by an anti-government militant named Timothy McVeigh, who in 2001 was later allegedly executed for his crimes. But this story, as so many other stories, are filled with things that doesn't match up. And about a year ago, I was contacted by an individual who claimed to have been offered $1 million to bomb this building. This was a year before the blast took place. And over this year, I've been coming closer and closer to him. I've seen a lot of the facts that he's providing. He's a former CIA operative. And at this point, I stand totally by his side, backing everything he says and trying to give him all kind of credibility with my name and person as well. So it is with extreme honor that I welcome Cody Snodgren to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Ole. Thanks for the opportunity, sir.
You contacted me because for some 22 years you have been fearing coming forward with this information because you have been involved in so many different areas behind the curtain of these dark operations and so on. So before we start, I know that it's a good thing to just make sure that we don't break any laws unintentionally and so on. So you have a text that you normally read out. So would you mind sharing that with us?
Yes, when in public forum, I just state the 1982 United States Intelligence Identities Protection Act. It's called the IIPA. It's United States Code Title 50, Sections 421, 426, and it states, "The disclosure of U.S. government operatives' identity is illegal only if it is done intentionally and with knowledge that the government is still actively maintaining a cover for such operatives." And the reason we do this is recently CIA officer John Kerouacou, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, he got 30 months in federal prison for violating it. And he was talking about the CIA's RDI, that's the Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Program. And he inadvertently mentioned somebody's name who was still active, so they hammered him and as a whistleblower and gave him 30 months in prison. He was sentenced in January 2013. So we don't want to put out anybody's name or anything. All we want to do is talk about stuff that's old and people that are inactive or dead. And so that's what this story, the caveat is. We're not doing anything illegal here.
I've focused so much of my life trying to let the truth do the work in a totally nonviolent way, just go into the belly of the beast, aim the light at the darkest of the dark, and let healing happen like that. And this is the way I see you, is that you come from the same point, and that is why I feel so honored to be here with you. But before we get into this whole thing, would you mind giving some background, maybe a timeline of your life and your time within the CIA or as an operative and so on, so we can get a better understanding on what led you to this point in life?
Yeah, we'll just do the briefly. Back in 1974 here in the U.S., I was graduating from high school in Dallas, Texas, and I took the physics SAT test going into college. And I scored in the top 1% of the whole United States. And I was also number one on the tennis team. I was a real good athlete, scored number one on the Marine Corps physical fitness test they gave. And so, you fast forward to, I got full tennis scholarships, and I was going to East Texas State University in 1975, and I was in the physics department there, and one of the PhD professors came in and whispered in my ear, there's someone here to see you. And I said, what is it? And he said, it's a job interview. And it was in the fall semester. I said, well, you know, the job guys don't usually come till May when the students are getting out of school. You know, who is here? And he whispered, he said, it's the CIA, that he's down there alone and wants to talk to you alone. And so after a while, I explained that I did not, you know, want to work for the government. I had kind of a revulsion for that. So he said, well, we can work something out. And so some time went by, and I had become involved with some Vietnam veterans, some of them which did work for the CIA over in Vietnam, and they'd been back to the States. And they began training me in all kinds of things. And so you fast forward about 1979, and I began working on my, I graduated with a double bachelor's of science degree in mathematics and physics, both. So then I went to graduate school at Stephen F. Austin State University in Texas in 1979 to work on my master's degree in physics. And while we were there, I got to fly the space shuttle simulator at NASA. It was a really neat thing. But anyway, we had already begun working in the black ops field. And so you fast forward to...
But Cody, hang on. When did you said that you said no to the CIA, but how did they... They got back to you, and then you started accepting their offer, or and what was the offer?
Yeah, well, what we did was, what I did was, I told them I did not want to directly work for the CIA. I didn't want any of their training. I didn't want anything to do. I wanted to be an independent contractor, and so that way I could take any jobs I wanted and do whatever I wanted, and I wouldn't be subject to them and their thing. And so I began working with these Vietnam veterans. And they began hiring me, you know, as an independent to do things. And then we'll get into all that later. So I did not work for the CIA and get a paycheck. I was just one of the assets and operators that are out in the black world that did jobs that the regular assets or agents or case officers didn't want to do.
So is this area, is that a big area? Are there many people like yourself that are out there without us knowing it?
Yes, a lot. That's how, and a lot of the people in that area were like the Vietnam veterans I worked with. You know, they had been in the military, and then they got all the training and combat experience, and they got out, and they were civilians. And so CIA or Defense Intelligence Agency or NSA, they looked at them as military, ex-military cutouts. So if they ever had a sensitive operation, you know, like a domestic operation to bomb the Murrah Building or whatever it was, their regular CIA agents and officers wouldn't have any blowback. They had the cutouts in between them who actually worked for the CIA and then people out in the black ops world who had no tie to them. And that way it maintained plausible deniability.
Yeah,
so there's a huge bunch of that. And the contractors that work for Eric Prince's, like Blackwater, a lot of the guys are like that. They're ex-military. They get the training. They don't get paid much in the military. And then they go out into this black ops world, and they take jobs, and they get a lot of money.
So how are these things financed? Where does the money come from? If there's no paycheck, is it handed over in cash or?
Yeah, it's the black ops world. Most of the funding comes in slush funds. You know, some of the JSOC teams, that's Joint Special Operations Command from the Pentagon and different things. If they need a job somewhere, say like down in Colombia, and they need some very sensitive things done, they usually pay in cash, or they can pay in drugs, or sometimes they pay in arms. Over in Africa, they might pay in gold or cougarans or maybe blood diamonds. The black ops world, that way, there's no records. There's no way to trace money to tie people together. And that's the truest black ops world. You know, in standard CIA operations, if someone like goes to the farm and gets training and they become a, a CIA agent or operative. They have an OCO or official cover operative. They may say, well, you're now working for the CIA, but your cover will be deputy press secretary to the State Department. So they give them an official government cover of forged identities saying, yep, you work for the embassy in Benghazi or wherever it is. And that's their official cover. And they go in and out of countries, and they have sometimes diplomatic immunity. And they can say, what are you doing in our country? And they say, well, I'm working for the State Department. Here's my badge. And the whole time they're really doing work for the CIA. But there's another aspect that's called a NOC. It's a non-official cover operative. And those are people that do work for the CIA and are on sanctioned CIA ops, but they don't have any official government cover. They can oppose as a oil worker or a journalist or any number of other civilian covers that fit the particular parameters of the mission they're in whatever country they're in. And then underneath that is the stuff that we did, the black operators that are truly, completely black. They do not work for the CIA, but they do have training and they do have things. And that way, if they get caught or tortured in a country, they have no tie whatsoever to anything in the CIA. They can be looked at as just regular criminals, and everything is swept under the rug. The one thing that you don't want to do in any kind of op, black op, is have blowback to your principles. And blowback is where you conduct the operation and it leaks back to the civilian press in the area or something. So a true black op stays black. Only the people that did it know that it happened. And there's a sanitization process where there's no witnesses, there's no physical evidence. We call it FOTINT, that's photographic intelligence. SIGINT, that's signal intelligence, like cell phones, or ELINT, electronic intelligence, you know, shortwave radio transmissions, anything like that. There's no forensic evidence, no footprints, no fingerprints, no DNA from hair samples. The black op occurs, and most people don't even know it occurs, and then the operatives leave. But once in a while, people get killed or mistakes are made, and the civilian domestic law enforcement in the area gets wind of it, and then there's blowback. And the principals do not want that blowback to come out. And that's why they hire people like us, like bombing the Murrah building. That job could not be done straight out of Langley. They could not hire CIA agents to go down there and set explosives and bomb that thing, because they knew it would be very public and very messy. So they had to have ex-military cutouts like Timothy McVeigh or me or any of the other ones to provide that barrier between them and what was going to happen. And so that's what we did.
Can I ask you, Cody, how does people in the Black Ops, how do they see themselves? Are they proud of it? Are they patriots, or are they just in it for the money? Or
yeah, boy, that's an interesting question. It's like saying how long's a string, you know. My motivation was money. I mean, my base pay was $20,000 a month U.S. And that was just to be on call and to go do jobs. And so my motivation was making the money, but I had to have a cover. I had to have a civilian cover. So what I did was, when I got out of graduate school, I began working in the oil business. I worked for Chevron Geosciences in Houston, Texas, and then went up to Amoco Production Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was a geophysicist. First, a petroleum geophysicist and a research geophysicist. So I was in mid-level management. I was making about $50,000 a year there at the oil company. And then underneath that was my civilian cover. And then underneath that, we conducted the black ops, which we were close to Arkansas with Bill and Hillary Clinton and all of that stuff over there. And we worked there, and we'll get into that at a later time. It's a lot of stuff. But anyway, the black ops guys, to ask your question, a lot of them were patriots in Vietnam. when they first went over there, and then they saw a lot of dirty things. A lot of them felt that our government had betrayed them and abandoned them. They got sprayed with Agent Orange. They became very disgruntled. They realized they'd been lied to, that that was a corporate war that just kept dragging on and on. And so when they got out, they came to the States, and, you know, they're bored, and they're sitting here after getting shot at for, you know, combat pay, which is next to nothing. And then they have all this training, and they're sitting here, just sitting here. And so they were perfect black operators. They had lost their patriotism, and they wanted the money. It's a lot of money. And so that's their main motivation to be a black operator is money.
So how did you, your lifestyle at that time, you had your ordinary job, but at the same time you must have earned so much more money. So what did you do with it? Did you have to keep a really low profile and just save it, or how did you live?
Yeah, that's a good question. When you're a black operator, you can't leave any telltale signs. Like, you can't go buy a new Ferrari or a limousine or things like that. And so what we were trained to do, we lived within the confines of our above-board civilian cover. So you live in a modest house. You might drive a car that's a few years old. Anything that goes in and out of your bank accounts is all perfectly matched to what your pay is. And that's your cover. It's a financial cover. It's a job cover. There's a physical cover. You know, your whole, your house, everything's normal. Wherever you are, you blend in to what's normal in that area. And then as far as the black ops stuff goes, sometimes we had jobs in Saudi Arabia for $50,000 a month to bodyguard some of those the royal family's nephews and sons. They were always worried about them getting kidnapped and so forth. And so we had bodyguard jobs over there, 6 month lock-ins, $50,000 a month, and so forth. But a lot of times we made extra money on the side during the course of an op, and so that money was all hidden. The money was laundered through various banks or hard assets like gold and silver. We used to take 100-ounce Engelhard silver bars, and we'd just take them and bury them somewhere and hide them. And all of that money had to be hidden. That's what black ops is. You can't show it anywhere except maybe out of the country or somewhere where your principals don't know about it. One of the worst things black operators can do, they start getting money, and then they go buy all this nice stuff, and it doesn't fit their cover, and that draws investigations from, you know, IRS and FBI and that kind of thing. So we were never allowed to do that kind of thing.
Were anyone in your family or close friends or so, were they aware of that you had taken the step into this world?
Absolutely not. My mother, my father, my wife, nobody. I had a wife back then. Absolutely not. That's what we operated in, a need to know. In other words, you only are told the bare minimum of information that you need to know to get your job done. For instance, in the Operation Centaur Rose, CIA operation over in Arkansas, they were doing a bunch of arms transfers down to Nicaragua. Ronald Reagan had ordered CIA to covertly arm the Contras against the communist Sandinistas down there. Congress had passed the Bolin Amendment forbidding a bunch of military activity. So he secretly ordered that. And in Centaur Rose, that was a in Arkansas to take weapons down there and then pay for it by bringing drugs back. So Congress didn't know about it. It was an op funded through the drug trade, and it was to arm the Contras against the Soviet buildup down there to maintain the balance of power. And so that's what that was. And in that op, you know, they would tell me, take this truck and drive it to a certain spot, like a Walmart parking lot. And then I would wear a blue baseball cap. I did not know who I was meeting. I did not know what was in the load. I did not know where it was going. All I knew was the need to know. I would pick up the load, the truck, it would all be loaded and everything, and I would just drive it. And they liked me because I had a perfect driving record, I had a perfect criminal record, and I had a civilian front as being a geophysicist. So if I was ever stopped by the cop, I was perfect. So anyway, I would drive it to, say, a Walmart, and I was told to meet a man. He'd come up, I'd open the hood and act like I was working on the motor, and then a guy in a red baseball cap would walk up, and we had a code. He would say, "Are you having engine trouble?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I think it's the starter. I don't know." And then he'd say, "Well, let me get in and help, and we'll see." And that was the code. That's how I knew who this guy was. And then he would start the truck, and I'd shut the hood and walk away. Then he would take the load wherever it was going. And that was a black op. That way, if I was caught or tortured, you know, then I wouldn't know anything. And so I found out later, after doing this a lot, that these loads were arms, and they were C4 plastic explosives and 1,000-foot rolls of deck cord. They'd all been stolen out of armories in the U.S., and they had a covert program to loot the armories and then send it down there to arm the Contras in Nicaragua. So I found all this out later, and they began to trust me more and more than we moved a lot of ordnance that way. But I was a black operator, and if they caught me, I had no ties to the CIA. I had no ties to any of it, and I would just be a civilian criminal, and it would be a operation where blowback was minimal, and plausible deniability could be maintained. So that was just one example.
Mm. It's standard procedure, isn't it, in all of these type of operations? Can I ask you when
it is.
When people hear about the CIA, many think that, oh, it's cool, you know, that it's in the movies and so on. But how would you describe just an ordinary CIA operative? Is there any type of individual that is, that you see often, or a certain type of person that is attracted into this area?
Yeah, that's why they do the psych profile tests and everything, and they have a big program where they watch college graduates, you know, that are good in things. It's a high intelligence like mine. I scored in the top 1% on a physics SAT test in the whole United States. So they try to pick people that have that mindset of high intelligence, and then they figure they can train it and mold it and get them to do, what they need to do. And so there's another part. What was the other part of that question? Please repeat.
If there's a certain type of individual that is attracted into these areas.
Yes. And they have a standard battery psychological test. I hear that they give at the farm. And this all ties into 1985. They had Project Slammer. And that was a FBI Behavioral Science Division and CIA joint op. They sold it to Congress to get funding so that they could develop psychological battery of tests. See, what had happened at that time, Olay, there was a guy named Aldrich Ames. He was a CIA agent. He was a station chief over in Moscow for a while, and the KGB had turned him. And he came back to the States and was selling them secrets. And then another guy in the FBI was Robert Hansen. He was, a 26-year FBI counter-espionage agent. And he had been turned by the KGB, so he was selling secrets. And then there was another guy, Scott Walker, I believe his name was. He was ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence. He was in the Navy, and he was selling the missile secrets from the submarines to the Russians. And so there's a whole spate of treasonous traitors that had occurred. And Project Slammer was developed to try to find out what were the traits, you know, that first drew people into this field. And then once they were in there as operatives, what made them turn to the other side? And this, the Behavioral Science Division, this was a 10-year project where they interviewed all these people who had been caught trading secrets. And they did psych profiles and studies, and they were trying to come up with a way to create future psychological battery tests so that the new people coming in, they could weed them out before they got into the intelligence field and then turn traitor. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and we can talk about Project Slammer later. That's a whole nother big thing. So,
but Cody, when you talk about the farm, could you explain a little bit about that for those who don't know?
Yeah, well, I was never there because I did not accept recruitment for them, but that's a standard place where it's around Langley there, and it's a place where they teach the new people out of colleges. They teach them wet and dry explosives, tradecraft, you know, how to tail people, how to plant and use electronic bugging equipment, killing techniques, escape and evasion techniques, some of the SEER program is survival, evasion, resistance, escape. They just teach them what their tradecraft that they need for whatever their operations are going to be. These agents usually are going to, some of them will stay in the U.S., some of them will be sent overseas. And I'd like to state here that there's a lot of really good people in the CIA. I know people from the Inspector General's office from the CIA. They're personal friends of mine. They've been in my house, and these are some really good people. There is a small group, however, that are like, you know, the rogue or the renegades who use their CIA positions and operations to conduct all kinds of dirty, nasty, filthy stuff for the shadow government. And those are the ones that we hope to expose and make people aware of, because they're ruining and killing, like the Oklahoma City bombing and that Sheffield thing up there in London, all around the world. They're involved in these murdering, killing black ops that really don't have that much to do with national security.
You know, this thing, national security, is always the way I see it, looking into so many different cases. Most of the time, this national security that is used, it's their security. They're just trying to cover their butt when with these stamps saying top secret and giving us 25 years without finding out or being given documents and so on. Would that be an accurate way of seeing it?
Absolutely. When a country, any country, Russia, America, doesn't matter, you have to have some kind of secrecy, and you have to have some kind of mechanism where intelligence operatives can do their jobs legitimately for that country. An example is the Manhattan Project in America here. You know, they were developing an atomic weapon. It was begun before Adolf Hitler had been defeated. They were in the fight of their lives, trying to defeat the satanic evil of Adolf Hitler. And they had to keep that weapon quiet. So there was a legitimate need for national security at that point. However, criminals, psychopathic criminals like Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, they use the cover of national security to conceal their own crimes. Okay? So there's a difference between those two. I know people that were at Los Alamos that worked there and witnessed the very first atomic weapon being detonated. Dr. James Cavanaugh was his name. He had two PhDs, one in geology and one in nuclear chemistry. And he worked there, and he eyewitnessed that. He rode in Jeeps with Harry Truman, and he had lunch with Albert Einstein at an American Chemical Society meeting. And he was involved in deep, deep national security there. But that's the legitimate side of it. The shadow government side of it is that they use the national security legitimate operations to camouflage up their assassinations and their crimes and all that other stuff.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
the way you see it, is there a need for the CIA as such?
Yes, there is, because there is evil in the world, great evil. And sometimes you have to be a little bit evil to take down the big evil. It's like the Nazi SS occult division. They were involved in high-level satanic spiritual stuff. I could talk for a long time about all that. But the point is that when a man like Adolf Hitler is murdering 6 million Jews with mass genocide, okay, that had never been done in world history. When that type of evil occurs in the world, we had the OSS back then, the Office of Strategic Services, run by Alan Dulles. That was the predecessor to the CIA. They turned that over in 1947. But when you have an evil that's that dark and that big, then you need something on that scale to be able to defeat it. In other words, you can't walk up to someone like Adolf Hitler and say, would you please stop killing those Jews because it's wrong? He has to be forced to do it. That's the only way you're going to stop a monster like that. And you have to kill him. You can't talk to him. You can't. You can arrest him maybe and put him in prison. But what I'm saying is, the CIA does a lot of dirty things and a lot of evil things and a lot of covert things. But in some cases, that is necessary, and it's what it takes to remove a deeper, darker evil. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand. I don't agree, but I understand what you're saying.
I know. I don't agree either, but I'm talking about the real world where terrorist groups, you know, they strap on explosives and just walk in a mosque and kill women and children. I mean, they will wear a suicide vest and walk in the middle of women and children and people at a marketplace and commit mass murder, random murder. They don't know anyone. They just are murderers. That type of evil, you have to have something to stop that or to try to contain it. Okay, if you're going to fight evil. I'm like you. I don't agree either. But I'm just saying that's the way you have to be operationally if you're going to confront that type of crazed, maniacal, psychopathic, sociopathic evil like Adolf Hitler or some of these Muslim suicide bombers and stuff. You know, we have to have intelligence on them. Someone has to get it. We have to know who they are in order to stop them. How many children's lives can you save if you conduct intelligence operations and then you find out who one of these guys is and then you stop him before he kills women and children?
Mm.
So that's why I think it's necessary to some degree.
Mm. Let's go back to the timeline again.
We were back in, 1980, so forth. I was a petroleum geophysicist, and then Operation Centaur Rose over there in Arkansas. There were three ops over there, Jade Bridge and Screw Worm or two of them. But I left Amoco, and then I couldn't take the conflict between trying to work a civilian job as a cover and then also doing all these other ops. It was just too much for me. I couldn't take the strain. So I quit the lower paying job, which was the geophysicist job. And then I just began totally working on black ops, and I did that ever since. I never worked anywhere in any civilian company after that. And so through the 80s, we did, we did a whole bunch of different things. And one of the jobs was, I was contracted to bodyguard Barry Sadler. He was a staff sergeant in the Green Beret. In 1965, he was in a play coup in the Highlands there and stepped on a punji stick, got an infection, and he went to the Subic Bay Hospital in the Philippines and wrote that song, Battle of the Green Beret. It was number one in the United States in 1965. And then I was ordered to bodyguard him 2 weeks before he was killed. That was on September 8th, 1988, I believe. They'd all took their training at Fort Benning in 1963 with the 20th Special Forces Group before they went to Vietnam. But he was involved in a lot of covert ops down there with arms deals and stuff. And they'd done a hit, the CIA had ordered a hit on him. So they ordered me to go bodyguard him. And 2 weeks before I was deployed to go down there, a CIA assassin named Rosin, he's gone now. He was in the Phoenix Project back in Vietnam, and they brought him out of mothballs to do this hit. And he shot Harry Sadler in the back of the head with a 380 auto, and it didn't penetrate his skull, but it went around the side and between the skin and his skull. And it didn't kill him. They put him in a civilian hospital in Guatemala City, and he faked a coma, so the CIA doctors wouldn't come down there with posing as doctors and give him a shot, you know, to finish the job. And he was brought back, smuggled back here to the States, and bounced around and ended up dying over in Tennessee near where his mom was living around Memphis. But that whole story's in the book. It's never been told before. A lot of conspiracy talk out on the internet, but I was involved in that. So we did ops like that all through the 80s, you know. And then you fast forward into the 90s, and in September of 18th, through the 22nd, I was at the Soldier of Fortune show in 1991. By that time, I had another civilian front, and it was being a machine gun and silencer dealer here in Colorado in a place called Scientific Systems. And we had Class 1, Class 3 licenses. Those were federal licenses where we could buy and sell machine guns, silencers, sawed-off shotguns. And I was the biggest dealer in the state of Colorado. Now, that was a front, too. I was ordered to do that for a front to conduct these other operations. But after Barry Sadler's assassination in 1988, we had been doing a whole lot of covert work, and I was with a CIA agent's son. I'm not going to name him, but he had died in the course of one of our ops, and his father had blamed me for the death. And so I was getting near the end of my career, and they targeted me for assassination in this Project Slammer. There was a below board, you know, the vanilla part of the op was to find out why spies turned, okay? And that stuff's on the internet. And that's what Congress gave funding to the Behavioral Science Division, the FBI, and the CIA for. They gave them funding for that. Yeah, we want to know why our spies are turning, and we want to figure it out so we can prevent it from happening again. But in classic CIA fashion, they went underneath that, and there was a black ops part of that. And they were using mind control tactics and behavioral science tactics, because you got to remember they were in the MKUltra program and all that other stuff, the Stargate program, remote viewing, all the stuff that's underneath in the black ops mind control stuff. We could talk for 5 hours on that. I know a lot about all that. But in the Project Slammer, they had the above board and then the below board, the black ops. And they were using advanced psychological and mind control techniques to find ways to assassinate people, okay, targets at a distance without leaving any traces, okay? One example was using microwaves and a microwave transmitter to hit a target. If you imagine a hot dog in a microwave and you just turn it on and let it keep cooking and the microwave swells up and blows up, they were experimenting with breaking capillaries in people's brains. You could hit them with microwaves and so forth and cause strokes. And then during a standard forensic pathology or any type of, they use GC mass specs or gas chromatography mass spectrometers. They do tissue samples to determine if there's poison or any type of thing. So there would be no marks, no traces, no bullet holes, no poisons, no nothing. Just a directed energy weapon that would kill a target, and they would die of apparently natural causes, and they could walk away. Now, I don't want to get into all this because I can talk for hours. I know a lot about this. Well, they targeted me with this stuff, and they actually killed me. That's when I died in the hospital. I died in the hospital during the Soldier of Fortune show between September 18th and 22nd, the 22nd in 1991. And I survived. I managed to survive. I was extremely sick for a while, but managed to overcome that. And
but
so,
what do you think did they hit you with?
Well, I'd like to do a different show on that. I can tell you what happened, but it's going to take a while to explain it because it involves very high level science and brain chemistry and so forth. But I know all of it, and we can do that. But what I want to do right now is step over that, because that Project Slammer stuff goes into the MK Delta, MK Ultra, the Stargate program with Joseph Mon Eagle and all the guys, David Moore, all of them that David Morehouse, all those guys that were doing the remote viewing and all that. We'll get into that. But
yeah.
Right now, we'll fast forward to there was the Randy Weaver thing and that happened up in Idaho where the ATF went up there and there was a shootout and his wife was killed and that was called the Ruby Ridge incident. The agents that were with me around the Murrah building time, they were all up there. And then we're going to fast forward up to February 28th of 93. That's when that Waco Branch Davidian fiasco happened, and you and I already talked about that. And then, so now what we're going to do is go from the 93 thing after Waco into 1994. I was getting ready to retire. I had planned to retire in 1995 in March. I had severe PTSD. I had trained in martial arts for 20 years. We had been in combat. I had died twice in the hospital and had to be shocked back. You know, my machine flatlined. I was clinically dead. I had crushed disc, herniated disc, broken ribs, fractured vertebrae, nerve damage in my arms, nerve damage in my legs, many broken bones, all that. I'm 100% totally and permanently disabled now with severe PTSD. That's what my medical files state. So in 1994, in the fall, in October, I was approached by one of the other contractors. His name is Harold Leonard, and I can tell his name now. I had to wait till he died before I could tell this story. He approached me. He called me one day, and we went to meet, and we always walked it way out in the woods somewhere. So there'd be no surveillance. None of the satellites can read your lips through the tree canopy, nothing. I mean, we're black operators. We know how to stop ELINT or signal intelligence. So he said, we got a job for you. And I said, where are we going? Saudi Arabia or Nicaragua? What is it? And he said, no, it's here in the States. And I said, okay, what kind of op is it? And he said, it's an EOD op. That's explosives and demolitions. That's a bombing op. And I said, well, what do you want done? He said, we want a building blown up. And I said, well, what kind of building? This was in October of 1994, about 6 months before the Murrah building. And I said, what kind of building? He said, it's a federal building. And I said, what? He said, yeah, it's one of our federal buildings. And I said, which one? And he said, it's the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City. And I said, are you fucking crazy? I said, I'm sick of this. I just went off on him. All these years of all these dirty things that we'd seen and done, it was haunting me. I had been drinking heavily. The only way I could handle my PTSD from all the things we'd seen was I would drink. When we got back from an op, I would just drink, and drown out my stuff. So anyway, I told him, I can't take this stuff anymore. I'm going to retire. I'm having bad dreams at night. I'm waking up kicking and screaming. I'm turning into a damn drunk, and I don't want this. And he pointed to a backpack. It was a purple and black backpack. It was laying there in the grass, and he carried out there, and he unzipped it. It had $500,000 in cash in U.S. currency. And he goes, look, we'll give you $500,000 now and $500,000 when the job's done. You can have a standard team. You pick your own team. You know, we'll give you all the stuff you need, explosives, whatever you need. Cover teams, surveillance ops, whatever you need. We just need this thing done soon. And I said, you don't understand. I just can't do it. You know, I'm not going to do this. This is our own country, and you guys have went too far. These are our own people. I don't mind going to Saudi Arabia and blowing stuff up, but I'm not going to do it here. this is my line. So at that point, I turned from a civilian CIA asset to a liability. And that's why I changed. I wrote the title of this book, Choosing the Light, because it was at that point where I'd had so much darkness and evil that my soul was being crushed, and I was dying inside, and I was becoming an alcoholic. And I had to choose the light. I just couldn't do that. I would have lost my soul had I taken that job. So then he offered me another job to do a bunch of hits, assassinations with some other areas that dealt with the Mexican drug cartels. And I told him, no, you don't understand. I'm not operational anymore. I can't go out in the field and do this stuff. I'm not capable. I'm afraid I'm going to nut up out there. I can't do this job anymore. And I'm quitting. And I never did anything after that. And so you fast forward 6 months or so, and then in April 19th of 1995, that building blew up. By then, they had approached Timothy McVeigh and got him to be the so-called Patsy. When they offered me that job, I'd been in the field a long time. And my sixth sense told me that this is a Patsy job. I'm fixing to end my career. What better way to shut me up and make sure I don't talk than to just use me as a Patsy and then kill me? Because you got to understand, Ole, I did not sign a national security oath. They could not hold me and say, you have to keep silent about all these operations or we'll throw you in prison. I didn't have a VA loan for my house. They had no way to control somebody like me. They had no way to shut me up except threatening me with death, which we're going to get into that later, which happened. But anyway, I turned that op down.
So do you think that the reason they approached you was indirectly to shut you up, to make sure that you wouldn't leak? It wasn't because of your professional background that you could do the job best of all.
Yes. One of the agents I talked to later, he said, I flew out to D.C. to talk to him. He said, you've got quite a file on you. The CIA knew what we were doing, but I was a black operator. But they knew about the black ops, whether they were sanctioned ops or not ops, because a lot of the operators, you got to remember, this is a big picture. Some of the guys that are CI operatives and they're on sanctioned CI ops, say down at Panama at the embassy or something, they're doing their job down there. But then on the side, they'll say, oh, look at all this cocaine laying here. We went in this place and there was $1 million in cash laying here after this big shootout. And so they do things on the side that the CIA doesn't know about. And so you have all of this black ops stuff that no one knows about mixing in with the legitimate CIA sanctioned ops. And so people are always flipping back and forth in this area. And the line between patriotism and treason is very, very thin here. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally see what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. So you can have a guy on a sanctioned CI op, and he's making, say, $75,000 a year, and he's down there in all the dirt doing all the stuff, worrying about his family back home, trying not to get killed, trying to get his job done and file his after-action reports and stuff so he can get back home. And then they walk into a cartel drug shootout or something that happened, and there's a $500,000 worth of heroin laying there. And all they have to do is pick it up, put it in a backpack or something and leave, or put it in a truck and leave. And then I can sell it down there, salt the money away. So they're making money two ways, one with the black ops stuff and then one from the sanctioned ops from Langley that they're getting a paycheck from. So this is how it works in the field. There's people that are on ops, and then they'll come to somebody like me and say, look, we don't want to get caught doing this stuff, so why don't you go do this and that, and we'll pay you, you know, $1,000 a day or whatever, and then we'll keep all this on the side, and Langley will never know anything about it. And that's very common, because we are all greedy for money, and we all like money. And so I'm just trying to clarify that this is a bigger picture than just what they paint in the movies and stuff like that. So So anyway, we were talking about the Murrah Building job. The Murrah Building blew up April 19th, 1995. And I immediately went black because I was afraid the CIA would kill me for having operational knowledge of their covert operation. It was a domestic operation. And
what does that mean? What does that mean when you say went black? Is that sort of underground?
Yeah, that means when you go black, you change to a alternate identity. We had false identities. We had disguises. We had everything that we needed for our tradecraft. And that was a domestic bombing op here in the U.S. CIA was forbidden to operate there. And so we have domestic law enforcement here to deal with FBI, DEA, IRS, cops, county, city. You know, so I changed my identity and changed my appearance. And I did not tell anyone where I was going. I used a series of transportations, drop cars and stuff. I went down to Oklahoma, and I knew some of the guys from Vietnam that were CIA assets over there that were now working domestically. And we had a series of safe houses down there because we'd been running those ops over into Arkansas, see, right across the border previously for Centaur Rose years before that in the 80s, 82, 83, 84, 85. So we had all the systems set up. I went down there to hide because I thought they were going to kill me, and just for knowing about it. And then the whole cover-up started with McVeigh and all that stuff happened. And I could talk for hours, but we're going to fast-forward past this right now.
But
I just have a few more things.
Cody, please tell me about when you heard of this alleged terror attack. I mean, you must have understood right away that, oh, my God, that was what they wanted me to do. What was the feeling? How did you experience the whole thing?
Well, when they offered me that job, I mean, in the first place, Harold Leonard, we'd done some work before together, and you know, I love Harold. He's a good man. He too had been all over Southeast Asia and everything, and when he offered me the $1 million, I tried not to let him know. That was absolutely ridiculous. I would never even consider a domestic bombing op here in the U.S. for anywhere between 20 to 50 million. I just wouldn't do it. I mean, the $1 million, I knew it was a patsy op. I mean, I just knew it. That's too low. That's, you know, in our line of work, you know, you've never seen a dead man care about money. So when they first said $1 million, I knew it was all an op. I knew it was a patsy op. I knew they just needed a fall guy, but I didn't let that on. And
do you think he was aware of that as well?
Oh yeah. Yeah, Harold knew. And I'm going to explain all this later about him. I have to get into time. We're in 2017 now. And there's a lot of time between what's happening now and what we're talking about back here in 1995.
Hmm.
And so let me finish this timeline and then ask questions here in a minute, because I just want to get through a few more things. It won't take long. But the Murrah Building had blown up at April 19, 1995. McVeigh had been the patsy with the Ryder truck and all that. What that really was an op on the inside. They had pre-wired that building. There were like three separate bombs. And I know all the reasons why that building was bombed. The things that were in there was extremely sensitive. It goes back to the cover-up of the Gulf War syndrome with hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars of medical culpability payments to the sick Iraq veterans. It goes back to covering up the records of the civilian law enforcement cover-up of Bill and Hillary Clinton and the Whitewater scandal and all the covert ops in Arkansas. There are several reasons why that building was bombed that most people don't know about, and we'll get into those later. But right now, okay, 1995, it was bombed. I went black. I figured since I knew about it, I knew there would be a domestic cover-up. I knew that McVeigh was the patsy, and I knew that the building had been pre-wired and everything. And so my associates had been in Vietnam. They said, you've got to go black. No one knows. We had safe houses. I was afraid the FBI or the CIA would just send someone to kill me, like they did Barry Sadler down there in Guatemala. So I went black, and all the stuff started. And then you fast forward to 1997, 3 years after that. or 2 years after that. And I was here in Colorado Springs, and the DEA and FBI had begun an undercover domestic law enforcement operation called Operation Stingray. And in that operation, they were targeting drugs and arms in the area. I had the biggest gun shop in the area, but had since closed it down. Well, I ran into undercover agent Blake L. Butler. That is his real name. This agent is a real ringer for the ATF. Everywhere he's been, people have been murdered. He was at the Waco Branch Davidian compound. We have video evidence of that. He was also at the shootout in Idaho with Randy Weaver, where his wife Vicky was killed, and he got a $3-something million wrongful death settlement. And he was also working at the Alfred P. Murrow Building, April 19th, 1995. Everywhere this guy's been, there's been murder, deaths, and cover-ups, okay? He was later awarded the nation's top cop award by Vice President Al Gore and United States Attorney General Janet Reno. So anyway, now here we are in 1997. And Blake Butler was the star undercover agent in Operation Stingray. And so I met him, and I'd begun selling him legal guns. And we had been doing that for a while. He said he had a special forces friend in Guam, over in Guam, where they were sending these weapons, and they were all legal, totally legal. And so on April 22nd, 1999, the Columbine High School shooting had occurred here in the States. And that was one of the biggest high school shootings in the history of the United States. That was April 20th of 1999. And all kinds of federal law enforcement were here. There was a lot of dead students. It was a horrible, terrible thing. We can talk about that more later. I know some of the snipers for the Jefferson County Police Department that were present at the scene. I can talk about all this stuff. I'm trying to just get the timeline done, and then we're going to be finished. So we're in 1997. Operation Stingray had begun. And by 1999, the Columbine shooting went off at April 20th, and Bill Clinton came here, U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. They were making a big deal about guns and all these dead students. And I went down to Bo's house on the 22nd of April, 1999. That was they had an undercover residence filled with 4mm cameras and surveillance gear as part of Operation Stingray. And across the street was a ATF DEA surveillance house. It was chocked full of telephoto lenses and electronic equipment, and that surveillance house was watching the undercover house across the street. So we were sitting there. I did not know that this operation was occurring. However, I had suspected it. So previously I'd taken some Russian night vision equipment and some drop cars, and we had went to put this Blake Butler guy under surveillance. And so I actually went to the surveillance house across the street and was sitting in the bushes. I didn't even know that the ATF and the DEA, that was their surveillance house. It was just simply the best location to surveil this guy from. Turns out they were there watching him, but they weren't there the nights I was there because they were tailing him as he left. He would always wear pagers. They were radio transmitters, and they would tail him in vans and follow him around while he was pursuing his undercover job. All right, so anyway, I don't want to get into too much detail, but this was all going on. So April 22nd, 1999, I went down there, and Bill Clinton was on TV and Janet Reno, and he asked me, what do you think about these guys? And I made the mistake of telling him about Operation Centaur Rose with Bill Clinton and the people I know with Janet Reno. I had friends that knew her in the Dade County no-knock narcotic squad when she was in Florida. And I talked about, he was trying to buy C4 from me, and I told him I don't do that anymore. I quit. And I ran my mouth about the Murrah building job. This was on April 22nd, 1999. Little did I know, all of it was being recorded. And I told him about, like I'm telling you right now, Ole, I'm telling him all the operational stuff about how I was offered the money and how they bombed the building and McVeigh was the pain and all the stuff. Well, he started fidgeting around. I did not know at that time he was an undercover ATF agent, and he did not know at the time that I was a independent contractor for CIA. And so we were both in an undercover mode. I was thinking I could recruit him maybe as an asset and then get him to work for me in my stuff. And he was trying to set me up, you know, to get a bus. So all this would come out later. What happened after that was CIA swooped in and took those tapes immediately. ATF said, hey, we got some guy here. We didn't know. He's talking all this stuff about bombing the buildings and the mess. Who the hell is this guy? And so CIA came in and swooped all the tapes. 5 months later, on September 16th, 1999, they planted me with evidence. Okay? They planted me with evidence. They took the planted evidence and went to the grand jury in Denver and lied to them. And they indicted me. And on my arrest on October 7th of 1999, there was about 75 ATF agents, and they had over 740 different law enforcement officers for me and the other guys that were on this indictment. And all this stuff's in the book. But while I was there, they were searching my Mercedes. I had just went to sell two machine gun silencers to another dealer, and I was about to go to Egypt the next day, to Cairo, Egypt, and I'd stopped to pick up about $8,000 in U.S. cash from Agent Butler. But instead of him being there, all these feds were there. So while they were searching the car and everything, up pulls this white SUV, and it's all smoked windows. It had civilian license plates. It did not say U.S. government. No external antennas. And the ATF guy, the commander in the field leading all the team, he touched his ear mic and said, yes, sir. And so he walked over there and opened the door, and he came back to me. And he said, okay, I'll take it from here. And all the other ATF agents said, why, sir? Aren't we going to arrest him? He said, no, this is something special. We'll take it from here. So they put me in the back seat. And we began the drive down to the Colorado Springs Airport. And sitting in the back seat was CIA agent. And he told me, he said, I flew out from D.C. to be with you tonight. And I said, well, due to your fine agents, I pointed up at the ATF guys in the front. I said, due to the fine domestic law enforcement activities of your agents here, with all due respect, you can't get the files on me. You don't have the security clearance. And the guy in the front, the ATF agent, turned around and he said, so what about Bill Clinton? And I said, what, are we on tape? Because, see, back when I made those tapes on April 22nd of 1999, I laid out to Blake Butler, unknowingly, all about the Clintons, the pedophiles, the sex rings, the drug operations in Arkansas, the arms dealing, the corruption of the Clintons. Even before they were in the White House. But you got to remember, this time now in 1999, Bill Clinton was the president with a lot more power than he used to have down in Arkansas. So I realized I was in deep shit.
Cody,
yeah.
We've come to the end of the first hour. And
okay.
Before we continue the second part, could you please tell our listeners how they can support you in your efforts, or how to get in contact, or how this book you're talking about, Choosing the Light, is there any way for them to get hold of that?
Yeah, what we have right now, I couldn't do this the standard way. Most authors will write a book first, and then they'll go out and do interviews and try to sell it. Since I could not get this book out and expose it, I was afraid I'd be killed, and the book would disappear. So what I have to do now is do interviews first, then get the book out later. So what we have now is edit copies on CD disc. We have three publishers and one movie company got talking right now. But if anybody wants a CD copy, they can order it from us. We have a bunch of them here. And all I do in this case is I give out my email, and if people want to contact us, then we can set up to get them a CD. If I'm still alive.
Is there any other way we can support you?
No, not right now. Just, you know, all I'll do is give out my email, and if someone wants to contact, maybe somebody has a story, maybe somebody wants a book, and then here we're in negotiations right now to sell the rights to all of this stuff, so all I can do is put out a few of these CDs if somebody wants one right at this point. We have some hard copies run off, and we're in the process of setting the whole deal up to get the publishing and PDF files and the whole thing. But right now, just I want to give out my email address, and it's my Indian name. I'm part Cherokee Indian and part white, and the email address is Cody, C-O-D-Y, Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N, Elk, E-L-K, at yahoo.com. That's Cody Golden Elk. That's my Indian name. So if you guys want a book or something, just email, and we got some other people who are in the business of taking care of that right now. Ole, I really want to appreciate you for helping us get this out, because the more that this gets out, the safer I'm going to be. The stuff that's in this book is very sensitive, but we did not name names of people who are active, and we don't want to violate any laws. What we do want to do, however, is expose some of the shadow government corruption about bombing our own buildings, terrorist attacks, false flag attacks, drug trade, armed trade, and how it's ruining our countries. It's not just in America. It's not just in Vietnam. It's not just in the deserts of Syria or in the mountains of Afghanistan or in the London subway system in England. These people operate transnationally, and they interface with and without intelligence agencies like MI6 and Israeli Mossad. I trained with some Mossad agents in Tokyo. But anyway, yeah, just for right now, let's just do that. And we have some people that'll take care of that, okay?
For anyone listening, I hope you understand what it is Cody is doing here. He is putting his life on the line to get the information out there in an effort to redeem things that he has been part of, but also to inspire other people in situations where they have a lot of secrets in their hearts, carrying around guilt, a lot of guilt. And by coming forward like this, I hope that this will inspire others to take the step forward and let these things out in the light. Let the light heal these dark, very sinister secrets so that we can transcend to the next level in this light and this world as well. So anyway, thank you so much, Cody, and we'll be right back for the second part.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.